All right, so to give you all a reason to be interested, I'm going to cut right to the chase, and then I'll go back and explain the robbery. So we had the RLC. This is what it looked like in about 1960. If you have an old world map, this is probably what you're used to seeing when you look at Central Asia and see the RLC. In 2000, this is what it looked like. These are satellite photos from NASA, this one and the next one. So you can see the sea has already started to shrink. And then the most recent satellite photos that have been published from 2010 have this. You can see the sea has essentially disappeared. What we're dealing with was once the world's fourth largest sea, larger than Lake Michigan. It was part of the former Soviet Union, now in Central Asia. What do we mean when we say Central Asia? So let's pull back here and try and add some space to this blank spot on the map. Often when I talk to people and say Central Asia, there's a lot of eyebrows that get raised. People say Stan, something like that. So if this were a smaller audience, I would ask someone to, you know, point out where do you think Central Asia is on the map. You can do that in your chair, you know, draw a circle or trace the border. Or if you don't want to look like a doofus, just think about it. But this is the region we're going to be talking about. That spot of map right there, it's really a throwaway slide. Here is a little more detail about the region. We're talking about the five former Soviet Central Asian republics. So we have Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan. And this is a pretty old map. You can see the RLC is pretty much intact in this picture. A little bit about the geography of the region. Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan are mountainous areas, about 95% mountains, some massive glaciated peaks, you know, 4,000, 5,000, some very large peaks in this area. And from this region come the two source waters of the RLC. There's the southern river, the Amudarya, which starts here along the Tajik-Afghan border and really forms the border all along here and then meanders between Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan all the way up to the southern portion of the RLC. The second river in this region is the Sirdarya, the northern river. Starts in the mountains of Kyrgyzstan up here, comes through Kyrgyzstan, passes through this Fergana Valley area in Uzbekistan, into Tajikistan, back to Uzbekistan, and then Kazakhstan before making its way to the northern part of the sea. I'll back up to overview of the sea itself. You can see where the two rivers enter, the northern Sirdarya, the southern Amudarya. Pretty thriving delta areas here, very green, lots of wetlands, very lush in both areas. Then once the rivers pass through the mountain areas, all of this is essentially arid, steppe, flat, grassland, deserty type areas. Turkmenistan is essentially all desert. It gets most of its water for the capital and for cities along here from a long canal that's diverted from the Amudarya. So it's about a 500-mile long canal that's been channeled through the desert that diverts half the water at this point through the desert, which, as we'll see, might not be the best idea for use of water. Within the basin, there's discrepancies between where water is produced, where water comes from, and where the water is used. So the big discrepancies here, the mountainous areas through snowmelt and glaciers produce most of the water in this basin. The blue is volume of water produced from these rivers. However, because of Soviet era allocations, most of the water is granted to the downstream countries, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan. This causes a lot of problems in the basin between countries that historically have been granted the water and make profligate use of it, and countries up here, Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, that would like to make better use or more use of the water that they see as a resource from their territory. So we'll see that this is causing problems politically in the basin. The history of water management in Central Asia, we'll break this into three parts. The first part, we have the pre-Soviet era. So this could be all the way up until in early 1920s. And during this time, agriculture was small scale, water use was small scale. So you had local communities that would dike or dam a river, divert a little bit of it to their fields, had a canal system. You know, irrigation is as old as the ages. So it's not a completely modern innovation. It was just the scale of it is much different. Small scale, you had a community that was responsible for its own irrigation system. There was someone like this guy, an aksakal, a white beard in the Uzbek language, who was a village elder, and he would be the overseer of the water management system. And he would appoint, or there would be elected a mirab, so a local water master. And then the water master would serve a term, and he would be overseen by this village elder. Elders are very respected in Uzbekistan as accumulating all this wisdom over the years. So they would be working in tandem to coordinate the management of this canal system, making sure everyone pitched in to clean up, keep brush out of the canals, make sure everything was working well. They owned their land, so they had an incentive to improve it and keep it working well, producing well, because they were invested in it for the future. In about the 1860s, the Russian Empire came in and started to colonialize Central Asia. The Russian Empire kept water management essentially unchanged in the region. They provided land tenure to the people that worked the land. So really nothing much changed during the imperial period. Big changes happened once the Soviet Union came in the 1920s, 1930s. And the biggest change of all can be traced to cotton. Now, cotton had been grown in Central Asia for quite a while, but the big first boom started in the 1860s. Now, why might that be? Any guesses? Where else in the world produces a lot of cotton? The American South. So when the Civil War happened, 1860s, cotton exports from the American South dropped precipitously. And people that, or countries that got their cotton from the South had to look elsewhere for sources. So Soviet Union, or at that time the Russian Empire, said we have all this land in Central Asia. There's two massive river systems. We can use some of this empty land and massive rivers to irrigate and grow some cotton. So cotton production started in the 1860s. It wasn't wide scale. There wasn't the large hydraulic works in place for it to be a massive enterprise. But it started about in the 1860s. When the Soviet Union came in, though, in the 1930s in the Fergana Valley, they started building large canal works to integrate fields with rivers. And cotton became the crop in Central Asia, a monoculture. During the height of the Soviet Union, the 60s and 70s, about 70% of the things planted in the region was cotton. And if you know anything about cotton, it's a very thirsty plant. It uses a lot of water to grow. And in a desert, it might not be the best option if you're looking to conserve water. And especially if your water management system is particularly leaky and inefficient. So there have been statistics looking at how the water efficiencies were in Central Asia, and they're mind-boggling. A place of this climate should be using about 7,000 to 9,000 cubic meters per hectare to grow cotton. But in some of these regions of Uzbekistan, this main cotton-growing area, they are using 20, 25,000, 30,000, in the driest areas right by the Aral Sea, up to 50,000 cubic meters per hectare for cotton. You know, about seven, eight times what would be an efficient operation. So about 70% of the crop was cotton. A lot of the expansion happened starting in 1960 when Khrushchev initiated this virgin land scheme. So Khrushchev looked southward to the plains of Kazakhstan, the deserts of Uzbekistan, and said, we still have a lot of empty area down there, and we can use that to produce cotton. Because the Soviet Union liked to locate its production in specific areas. So you would have a city dedicated to refrigerators. You would have a city dedicated to metallurgy. So Central Asia became the cotton area, and with pretty devastating results, as we'll see. A second shift in the Soviet period was a focus on large infrastructure, and large infrastructure being big dams, big canal systems. In the late 1950s is when that canal from through Turkmenistan, through the desert, was built. You know, this 500-mile-long canal to essentially irrigate the sand. This here is the Nurek Dam in Tajikistan. It's the world's tallest dam at 300 meters, so about three football fields, a little more than three football fields tall. And again, just a massive block of concrete in a river valley. The Soviets built several of these big dams in Central Asia, mostly in the mountainous areas of Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Several dams that were planned are unfinished and are a point of contention between the countries who would like to see the dams finished so they can get some hydroelectric earnings from them, and the downstream countries that really don't want to see their water being diverted. A third shift in the Soviet system was an integration of the water management structure. So in the pre-Soviet period, we saw that everything was localized, small scale. There were irrigation systems, but they operated independently of one another. But the Soviet Union came in, subsumed the entire region, and integrated its water management infrastructure so that those mountainous upstream countries became the water producers, the downstream countries became the water consumers. So they allocated the water that way, and in return, the downstream countries like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, which have a lot of oil and gas, what they paid for the water in kind with energy supplies. So the upstream countries would send their water southward in the summer. They would hold the dams, build the dams to hold it back, send it southward in the summer to irrigate, and then in return in the winter they would get gas and oil so they could heat their houses. And this worked pretty well when it was one unified system. But since independence, this is all politically collapsed, but infrastructurally remains the same. So you have these guys, the presidents of the now independent republics, wanting to go their own way with water management. Some want to do more hydropower, some want to continue the irrigation economy. But they can't really do that because their system is unified. So you have a lot of push and pull between the leaders, no real agreement at all between any of these guys. There was some, you know, right after the independence period, there was a few piecemeal agreements, kind of wink and nod, yeah, we'll do this, because that was a time of a lot of consensus building internationally. A lot of water management, environmental agreements were signed. In 1992, you have Kyoto and the Biodiversity Protocol, and wetlands, and desertification, all these big international agreements that were signed. So there was a real international push for, you know, signing these type of things. And there were quite a few agreements that came out of the basin. But the provisions haven't been implemented. They've essentially tried to go their own way and called names, called the other people names. Which brings us to the RLC. These are water levels for the sea in the last 250 years. So starting in 1760 up until about 1960, you can see the water level stayed within a 2 to 3 meter range. And then right in 1960, when the Virgin Land Scheme started and there was real intensive development of the basin, it's like the first drop on a roller coaster. And we can see that from the water inflows to the RLC. So historically, about 50, 55 billion cubic kilometers a year went into the sea from these two rivers. But once this intensive irrigation program started, dropped to 43 on average for the next decade, dropped to 17 on average in the 70s, and then dropped almost to nothing in the 1980s. There were many years in that period where no water reached the sea. We're not ready for that. The Soviet engineers knew this was happening. There are memos, there are journal articles in the 1960s from Soviet hydrologists saying, all right, we divert this water, the sea is going to dry up. Not now, 20, 30, 40 years from now, it's going to disappear. And the fact that they knew this means they're working on some solutions. And I think it's tragicomic to look at the solutions that they proposed. Kind of a picture into the Soviet mindset, into the picture of really any centralized development mindset. So one solution was to build a canal from the Caspian Sea to the Aral Sea. So Caspian's bigger than the Aral Sea. It's got some extra water. We'll just shuffle a little of that over eastward. Second solution was to build large-scale forestation works to prevent soil degradation and things like that. A third solution was called the Siberian River Scheme, where there would be a canal dug from Siberia, from the Irtysh River, through Kazakhstan to the northern part of the Aral Sea. And we'll just, no one lives in Siberia. They're not making use of the water. We'll just take some of that and funnel it down. They were going to provide about 60 billion cubic meters a year, 60 cubic kilometers, from the Siberian rivers, which would have been, what they were taking out for cotton irrigation. This is still bandied about as a solution. The sea is shrinking. There's no political solution. So every once in a while, someone throws up, why don't we just divert the Siberian rivers? But my favorite solution that they proposed was to drop a few nuclear weapons in the mountains on the glaciers to melt the glaciers and send this massive tide through the mountain valleys to fill the sea. So these are the solutions to the problem. You can solve a lot of things with a nuclear weapon. Maybe gushing oil wells under the sea. Maybe shrinking seas. But it didn't happen, so we'll never know if it would have actually worked. And ironically, the only thing that could really have saved the sea was the continuation of the Soviet Union. Because in the 1980s, there was a lot of pressure from environmental groups, from writers in Uzbekistan, who could see what was happening. Their families were getting sick, crops drying up. They put a lot of pressure on the Soviet Union to do something about this. So the Central Committee of the Communist Party got together in the 1980s, and they said, all right, we should do something. They put a plan in place to gradually increase the inflows into the sea up to, I think, 20 cubic kilometers by 2005. This plan was put in place in about 1989. Whether they're serious about it or not, we'll never know. It's a tantalizing what if. But it showed they're doing something about it. Whether it worked or not, we don't know. But now that the politics in the basin is fractured, the best way of saving it would have been continuation of the communist system. All right, so the aftermath. Now that it has shrunk, what are we looking at? So first, there's widespread salinization and widespread deposits of salts all over the basin. Salinization of the soils everywhere because the water is poorly drained. So it waterlogs the soil, the salts and the fertilizers accumulate there. And even though in this independence period the amount of cotton in the basin has shrunk to about, well, we'll look at Uzbekistan since it's the main cotton producer. Uzbekistan is one of the world's leading exporters of cotton. It was about 70% cotton during the Soviet Union. Now it's about 35% cotton and 30% wheat, as there's a big push for self-sufficiency. But the soil, even though cotton use is dropped, cotton production has dropped, water use is not, because the soil is so saturated with fertilizers and salts that before planting, the fields have to be flushed so that it washes the soil, the salts away. So water use is still essentially the same. Irrigation system is quite leaky. There's no real incentive for farmers to improve the irrigation system if they're getting their water for free and it's allocated legally to them. There's been some studies done to see how much it would cost to renovate or to update the irrigation infrastructure. And one estimate was $16 billion to update everything in Uzbekistan. A lot of money for poor farmers, and the state's not going to do it, to save 12 billion cubic meters per year. So a lot of money to save not a whole lot of water. So the soil is salinated. The sea itself has become what the Uzbeks call the Akkum, the white desert. To the south, there's the Kızılkum, the black desert. to the northeast, there's the the Kizilkum's the Red Desert. There's the Karakum, the Black Desert, to the northeast. And now the Aral Sea seabed has become the Akkum, the White Desert, because of all of this salt that's on the seabed. The salt gets picked up by winds that are fiercer now. The climate around the sea has changed. Water has a moderating effect on climate. So now these salts are being picked up and blown around the area, deposited in the glaciers, even in the mountains to the east, causing the glaciers to melt more quickly. Again, just a reminder of what it looked like in 1960. This little speck right here is an island called Vozrezhdeniya Island. It means rebirth island in Russian. And ironically, it has been reborn as part of the mainland. Why is this important? In the 1950s, 60s, the Soviet Union had its biological weapons program, and they're looking for a place to put it. They put their weapons testing programs in remote areas of the Union. So they see an island on a sea in the middle of the desert and say, what a great place to test some anthrax, some botulism. So this is where the weapons testing program, bioweapons testing program for the Soviet Union was located. Not a big problem when it's isolated in the middle of the water, but now that it's part of the mainland, there's huge ecological concerns and huge security concerns about this. After September 11th, the U.S. became concerned about this. Unsecured bioweapons in the Uzbek desert when there were Uzbeks in Afghanistan. So the U.S. paid some money, did a program with the Uzbeks to clean up this facility. A couple $100 million right after September 11th. But it wasn't completely cleaned up. No one that I've talked to really knows the status of this facility. There's concerns that there's animals, wildlife that will just, camels, deer, things that will just be walking across the seabed, go into this area, eat some stuff, be exposed to some stuff, and carry it outside of the weapons area. There's a short video I'll show, since we have enough time. A British guy, the plucky British, went and paid some Uzbek smugglers to get into this island and see what it was like. So I think it's extremely interesting, in my opinion, and I think you'll like it. But it's about 7 minutes long. He's a little bombastic, so.
Welcome to Anthrax Island.
Take it with a grain of irrigation salt.
As far as we knew, we were the first British people ever to set foot in this place. As soon as we arrived, even though the former research base was still 25 miles away, Dave advised me to put on the bioprotection suit. We offered the same suits and masks to the locals, but astonishingly, they declined our offer, telling us they'd visited the site many times and never got sick. Riding pillion on the rickety old bikes, we left for the 2-hour desert ride to the bioweapons site. We got there just before midday, as the temperature nudged up above 40 degrees. The looters vanished into the city on their mysterious mission, leaving us alone to explore this deeply disturbing ghost town. From the late 50s to the early 90s, this was home to several thousand biowarfare specialists, their support staff and families.
Vos Island Bioweapons Research Testing Station Housing Complex. So it's gone midday. Took 8 hours to get here. I still can't believe it. But what an extraordinary place.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting. This looks like it has a template.
It was clear the Soviets had left in a hurry. But what had they actually done with the huge stocks of weaponized smallpox, the anthrax, the botulinum toxin?
And all sorts of just weird stuff going on. I don't know what this place was, what those was before. Just like the fall over. The bullies can go in or you feel safe to go in. Most of them have been so badly smashed up, I don't want to actually venture inside. Because they look potentially dangerous. And when I stop like that, there's a silence that's truly eerie.
We left the housing complex and entered the nerve center of the laboratory itself. In these buildings, the Soviets concocted the most virulent strains of bacteria known to man. We made a sinister discovery just inside the door, a respirator lying on the floor. A clear sign that something potentially lethal might be lurking within. These rooms were straight from an Orwellian nightmare. I wondered what unfortunate soul had been strapped to that bed. At that moment, a pungently strong smell entered the respirators.
Daddy, yeah, I can smell the urine.
Yeah,
had a night.
Yeah.
I do as well.
Yeah, smell. It's got ammonia.
Yeah, it's ammonia. Just leave it. That's what I'm saying. Okay. I need the same kind of ammonia as well.
A few moments later, the unknown chemical still stinging my nostrils, Denny decided we should beat a retreat.
So you get the idea. Here's a satellite. Images of the facility. There's the bioweapons lab to the southeast, and then the housing units that they pass through to the northeast. And as Mansur Olson said, you can never change just one thing. These are systems that people mess with, and whole scores of unintended consequences happen. So how about the aftermath socioeconomically? Increased in morbidity and mortality. The dust that's been picked up from the seabed has been spread around the people living in the area. Highest incidences of lung cancer in the world are around the sea, former sea. TB has gone up. There's a lack of water to wash with, so waterborne diseases, water wash diseases going up. The sea itself was a massive economic machine for the Soviet Union, for the people living there. Fish stocks, fishing industry was big. Scores of species of fish live there. Sea recedes, fish go down. Most parts essentially dead. There are some areas of the sea where fishing is recovered, and I'll talk about that at the very end. But another funny anecdote here. As the sea started to recede and the fish stocks started to die off, there were all these people that were living there. There were canneries. They had livelihoods that were disappearing. So the Soviet Union decided to keep them employed by providing fish for the fisheries to can. Well, that's a problem when you're in the middle of the desert. Where do you get the fish from? The solution was to truck in by train and truck fish from the Baltics across the east, western Russia, down through Kazakhstan, to the canneries in Uzbekistan for the people there to have something to put in cans. That's a huge problem. The bigger is better mentality, again, these huge, large-scale fixes are the solutions people see. So again, the Siberian River scheme is still bandied about as a solution. Just divert the rivers, build another large canal. not change the system, but just extend it. The people around the region, the people living around the former RLC, are someone called the Karakol Paks, and it's an ethnic minority within Uzbekistan, and they've been the ones hardest hurt by this. They're the ones living around the former sea. They're the ones with the health consequences. But the Uzbek government, you know, in a word, really doesn't care about them. They're politically marginal, far from the nerve centers of the country. They're out there. So the Uzbek government is very willing to receive assistance from Doctors Without Borders, from the International Red Cross, to go in and help these people, because it absolves them of responsibility for dealing with it and gets some assistance to the people, too. And again, the aftermath is still this integrated infrastructure, in that the dams and canals are set up to provide irrigation water in the summer and fuel in return in the winter. The Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan would like to build more dams to make use of the hydroelectric potential in their mountains. Tajikistan has one of the highest hydroelectric power potentials in the world, but makes use of a couple percent of it. Because one, it's costly to build dams, and they just haven't had any support for it. All right, I do have good news. We're going to end on an upper. The northern part, I included a little thumbnail so you get a sense of aspect here. The northern section of the RLC, this little smudge right there, is doing well. I'm happy to report. The sea, yes, has gone down by about 90%, but this part here is fed by the Sir Daria, the northernmost of the two rivers. The Sir Daria enters around here. And as the sea receded, there was a channel between this north part and the southern part. And the people living around here in the city called Aralsk had been building earthen dikes to prevent the water from flowing from the northern part to the southern part. But they were pretty rudimentary, and they kept getting washed away in floods and high inflows. So then the World Bank came in and funded a dam project called the Kolkaral Dam. It started in the middle 2000s, completed in 2007. And their anticipation was that it might raise the water level in the northern part of the sea 3 meters in about 10 years. That's what they're hoping. And much to their surprise, and everyone's surprise, in 7 months, the sea rose 3 meters. This is a huge success. It's brought back livelihoods to the port city of Aralsk. The fishing stocks have recovered. Salinity has gone down. There's been some rehabilitation of the river below this from Kazakhstan's part. But it's actually doing better than anyone expected. So there are plans to do a second phase to this project, meaning building another canal, clearing out some of the old infrastructure down or upstream to improve the flows into the sea. So the prognosis for this area is actually pretty positive. The prognosis for the southern area is very grim, and that it's possible for it to recover, but not likely in the near future, because it would take a change in the political system and a lot of political will on the parts of Uzbekistan especially to make the changes to allow more water to go into the sea, to update irrigation. But as it stands now, the sea as it was is not coming back. It would take many decades of limited abstractions for the water to come back to anything like its former size. Something like 75 years for it to refill. So that's not going to happen. But there can be some small improvements if there are changes made to how the water is governed. But again, the big success story is this northern section up here. If this has been at all interesting to you, there's some things you can read. Chasing the Sea was a book by Tom Bissell. He was a journalist who went. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in Uzbekistan, left or was kicked out, and then went back a couple years later and journeyed through the country to the RLC, just seeing what it was like. And it's a pretty entertaining book. If you don't have time to read a whole book, then there's... he wrote an article for Harper's that is essentially the book condensed to about 50 pages. And then I always take a chance to plump for my organization, Circle of Blue. I think we do a pretty good job most times of covering stuff. And we have some interviews with people working in the RLC and some news stories about the RLC in Central Asia, water management, if you want to take a look at that. Other than that, I left a little time for questions if you have any.
Any update on the security risk of the island?
I was in Nairobi in March, and there was a World Water Day, and there was the leader of an NGO in the region, the Union for the Defense of the RLC. And I talked with him, and I asked him about this. And he said there really is no information that he has seen within Uzbekistan. So I don't know. I would really like to know, and I'm trying to find out. But right now, I don't know.
I wonder how similar the actual ecosystem is in the small section of the lake there towards compared to what it was in, say, turn of the century the whole way. Is it just about the same mix of...
They've had to reintroduce species, so they're reintroducing the natives. It's not as good, obviously, but the delta area is recovering. There's wetlands that are recovering. So progress is being made. It's too early to make any large-scale pronouncements on it, but it's getting better.
How much have the glaciers that feed the whole thing through the rivers melted, and what is the prognosis for the long-term prognosis for that?
Yeah, climate change is going to have a huge effect, not only on the RLC, but the entire politics of the basin. The assumption is that water inflows will increase in the short term as glaciers are melting and drawing down this ice bank. The estimates right now, it's hard to say for sure because there's not a whole lot of monitoring stations above 3,000, 4,000 meters. But right now, the estimates are that they're declining at about 1% per year. And that in Tajikistan, in the last 50 years, the glaciers have declined about 20 to 30%. So short term, more water. But long term, by 2040, 2050, the river flows are going to be decreasing about 10 to 20% estimation. So that'll cause problems for irrigation if there's not any way to improve the Lehi system or... match crops to water availability.
Is the continent of agriculture still going full bore, or is there any effort to curb it?
It's been cut back after the fall of the Soviet Union for food self-sufficiency, more wheat. But it's a huge money earner for the Uzbek government. It's about, cotton is 25% of GDP, foreign exchange, about 25% of foreign exchange. So there's, it's a money machine. It's how they get cash. And the way the system is set up is that farmers don't have land ownership and no right of transfer. And many of them, there's lots of farming categories, but a lot of farmers are told to plant X amount of cotton. And the system is farmed by school children. So I've had friends in Uzbekistan say, everyone gets out of school for a week to go pick the cotton crop. It's a form of child labor. Walmart was discussing boycotting Uzbek cotton because of this. I don't know what became of that. But I had friends who say, if you're well off, you just pay a little money and you get out of the cotton picking. So it's a bad situation. In not only Uzbekistan, but Tajikistan too. It's the same cotton dynamic.
What was the topography like on the bottom of the lake? It looks like it's a very shallow... Like, how deep was it at its deepest point, and where was that deepest point? Mm.
The part that shrunk the most is the most shallow, and that's what the pictures I saw. Its water level's gone down about 40 meters, so that would be about the deepest point, 40 to 45 meters. But the southern end is the shallow point, and that's where the big recession has happened.
Was it historically, at least over the last... few thousand years, did it fluctuate a lot?
In the last 200, it was fairly stable. Yeah. but you know, big river systems change course over time. So before those 200 years, there were sometimes the Southern River flew into the Caspian. Sometimes it terminated at a depression south of the Aral Sea. So there's been historically over millennia a lot of variation, but you know, within modern time period, it's been stable up until 1960. Yeah.
To what extent the progress in northern part of Aral Sea is related to better governance in Kazakhstan, comparing with Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan?
Yeah, governance is the key in anything, in that you have to want to do something. And the Kazakhs want to do this. They have aspirations. You know, regional leader, global leader. And it doesn't look good if you're letting your ecology shrivel. So yeah, it's governance is the big issue.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.